The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Lawrence Wright, acclaimed by the Washington Post for bringing a clear-eyed, investigative fearlessness to a diverse range of topics. Lawrence Wright is a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He won the Pulitzer Prize for The Looming Tower, an in-depth history of the rise of violent extremism and the intelligence failures that might have prevented the 9/11 attacks. His many other nonfiction works include books about journeys into the Lone Star State, the secretive world of Scientology, and the figures comprising contemporary American religion. A member of the Council on Foreign Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Society of American Historians, Mr. Wright has written and performed 2 one-person plays and co-produced the Emmy-winning documentary Going Clear. He recently published The End of October, a best-selling and deeply prescient novel about a devastating medical crisis. His newest work is called The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID, a sober look into the impact of COVID-19, the initially slow government response to this crisis, and the medical professionals working to save lives and educate the public. The New York Times Book Review calls it a book of panoramic breadth, ranging from science to politics to economics to culture, with a commanding scrutiny, managing to surprise us about even those episodes we have only recently lived through and thought we knew well. Tonight, Mr. Wright will be joined in conversation with Tamela Edwards, anchor of 6ABC's Action News Morning Edition, and more importantly to us here, a longtime friend of the Free Library, and especially us here in the author events office. Lawrence, Tam, thank you so much for being here, and take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason.
All right, Jason, it is great to be here. Lawrence, thank you for being here tonight. I enjoyed the book and I learned quite a bit. But I wanted to start by asking you why, which may seem like a strange question. Of course, it's a fascinating topic. It's where we were living the entire time, but a lot of this was going on contemporary. There was so much out there. What made you decide that you too wanted to step in this pool of trying to go deeper and make sense out of what we were living through?
Well, Tam, the quick answer is I didn't. I was avoiding it. I had already written the novel and I thought I was done with it. I didn't want to join the press scrum, the writing about the Trump administration. So and whereupon I got a call from David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker, along with my editor, Daniel Zaleski. And this was in June of 2020. And Remnick asked me, he wanted to do what he called the big dumb story, which is, you know, the like many publications, we'd done a number of articles about the pandemic, but we hadn't done a comprehensive look. And I was reluctant, but I said, let me think about it. When I thought about it, I began to realize how comprehensive the damage has been to our society. It touches everything. It touches politics, the economy, science, culture and arts. There isn't any part of our lives that wasn't touched. And so once I thought about that, I think it became a huge challenge to figure out how to actually write about it. And I decided that I would take, institutions, that are characteristic of our society, like the Congress, Broadway, Wall Street, a major hospital, in my case, Bellevue, and then try to find inside those institutions exemplary figures who could tell the story. And in this, I was just unbelievably fortunate. Luck played a huge role in this particular project for me.
I loved the way that you did it because you continue to find individuals and walk us through what was going on by standing in their shoes. And it just brought something different to trying to understand what was happening. And in the bigger picture, I mean, where to begin? I didn't know whether or not to laugh or cry. When you, and you quietly let some stories tell themselves, you didn't do a lot of judgment or editorializing. But, you know, I just wrote down three examples. The failed COVID test, with everyone begging, can we get rid of one part so the rest of it works? And they're making it in a dirty lab. And even the most basic college scientist knows you don't do that. Or the comma tragic search for gear, governors get their gear, and then the president swoops in and takes it after telling them you're on your own. Or the politicization of masks. I mean, I'm amazed that more people aren't dead.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. It there were a lot of heroes at the same time who stepped up, you know, and, you know, the governors were thrown into, you know, they had no idea that the government, the federal government, wasn't going to help them. There was a call between, they had a weekly call between the 50 governors and the president. And in March, I think it was last year, he said, we're behind you, you know, we're going to be there, we're supporting you. But then he began to explain what that meant. As for personal protective equipment and ventilators and masks and gowns, you get it yourselves. We're supporting you, but you get it yourselves. And Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, told me that she realized at that moment, Michigan was out. They didn't have enough PPE for the next shift. It wasn't a matter of weeks or months. And the national storehouse was severely depleted. And, you know, all the governors were competing against each other. And Gina Raimondo, who was the governor of Rhode Island, you know, she didn't have much sway in Washington, the smallest state. So she kept begging for a shipment from the national storehouse, which was so depleted. And finally, they said it's on its way. And they sent a truck and it was empty. And to me, that is like the signal moment of how the Trump administration handled the pandemic. They sent an empty truck.
And, you know, you talk about how we got here and you talk about some of the cross currents of the politics of Trump being in the seat, because you can't help but wonder what would have happened if somebody else was sitting in the seat. And you talk about Matthew Pottinger, who's working at the White House, and he sees some construction workers the day after the 2016 election, and they're euphoric. And you say they felt like they were finally seen. And this seems to run through the book, that what happens when people aren't seen, that that's a danger for them. But you mentioned other groups, race, entire groups of people losing, you call them, they could have been little Einsteins and they were forgotten. Or you talk about the income inequality, that people now are less likely to make as much money as their parents did the year that they were born, Raj Chetty, that it feels as though we're on the verge of any of these groups making poor decisions because they don't feel seen.
Yeah. You know, the question that raises, Tam, is, will we be different people now? You know, we've had this pandemic. There were maybe a lot of lies we told ourselves about what kind of country we are. For instance, there was a study of the all the countries in the world, which one was the best prepared for facing a pandemic. And number one was the United States. Number two was the UK. So it was, you know, if you turn that up, if you turn it upside down, it would have been a more accurate picture. But, you know, it was, we were under an illusion that we were a society that could take care of these things. And that was wrong. Now I think we've been educated. And I compare the pandemic to an X-ray that allows us to see into our society and all the broken places. We have the opportunity to repair those breaks and be prepared, for instance, for the next pandemic, which will come, and we may not suffer as much as we did this time. But honestly, in my opinion, after studying this carefully, every country was going to suffer. There was no question that there was going to be a toll exacted. And in the United States, tens of thousands of people would die, but maybe not hundreds of thousands. The absence of leadership played a a crucial role in this.
You say that, and that's a positive way to look at it. But I would say by the end of the book, I was left with a different feeling, especially the sections that you spend on 1918. And it's almost like an echo over time, that all of the same fights to mask or not to mask, to shut things down, to open things up, why cities fare well. Of course, here in Philadelphia, we fare terribly.
Right.
The same things the governor's dealing with right now, open up right now, is the same thing back then. And I felt like if we couldn't learn then, if that didn't really stay with us and here we are we not doomed to be back here in 50, 75 years? Is it just natural that humans forget, and even something as searing as this pandemic, we will forget and do this all over again?
Damn, that's the most likely outcome. I wouldn't doubt it. It's happened in the past. 1918, as you rightly point out, was buried in human consciousness. And you will, if you want to read of that era, what you'll read about is the First World War, which was happening at the same time. Although the influenza killed more soldiers alone than the war did. It killed between 50 and 100 million people across the world, and 675,000 Americans. So it was one of the most concentrated, it maybe was the most concentrated pandemic in history. And yet within a few years, there was a roaring 20s and nobody remarked it. I talked to a medical historian in Bologna, Italy, Gianna Pomata, who used to teach at Johns Hopkins, and she's a charming woman. And I asked her, looking back over the course of history at the pandemics of the past, what did this remind her of? And she put her finger, I was surprised, on the Black Death, the plague in 14th century Italy. Now, obviously, the scale of death was far greater. It killed a third of Europe. But what interested her about the comparison of then and now is that was in the Middle Ages. And people realized that whatever they were doing wasn't working. And especially medicine, that was it was called academic medicine, but a lot of it was just reading the horoscope. And obviously that didn't work. And so they opened their minds to fresh thinking. And that fresh thinking is what led to the Renaissance, perhaps the greatest, most creative period in human history. And neither she nor I are advocating that we're going to have a Renaissance, but changes are underway. And, there's a reset in labor, for instance, that you can feel happening right now. People are mixed about going back to the jobs they left. They don't want to go back on the same terms. And that's an interesting development. I think being essentially isolated for a year and a half has taught people a different kind of life. Maybe, it's impoverishing in some ways, but in some ways enriching. So I think people have made discoveries about themselves, and we're only now beginning to sort out how our society is different.
As a friend that likes to say, maybe the universe is giving us a shove in the direction we need to go. It's not pleasant, but you end up on the right path.
I think we might look back at this as we were lucky to have this pandemic and not one that, for instance, SARS-1, this pandemic, you killed about 2% of the people. SARS in 2003 killed 10%. MERS, another coronavirus, killed 35%. So we could have, had they been as contagious as this, we would have been in a completely different place right now.
I know you said at the start that you didn't really want to join the scrum around Trump, but obviously he's a central figure in the book. And you just have a line in there, in the end, he was not a leader, but a saboteur. And as you lay it out, it's not that he was incapable. You point out that there were moments when he did the right thing, when he closes the borders with Europe, when he says we've got to do a larger shutdown. He has moments. And then there's this like general fallback that doesn't necessarily make any sense. So in the end, I'm sure you're asked this all the time, how do you assess him and what happened here and why this was the way he carried everything versus continuing down a path to be more like an FDR or another leader in a crisis who gets you where you need to go?
Yeah, I feel like he doesn't get credit for the things he did right. Let me just set that straight. You know, the great thing that the Trump administration did was Operation Warp Speed. And really what that essentially was is guaranteeing the pharmaceutical companies that the government would compensate them for their research, whether their vaccines worked or not. And it was a tremendous advance because at the time people were talking about the vaccines being available in the fall of this year. Imagine with all the variants that are racing around this country right now that are 60% more contagious than the original. Imagine what our country would be like if we had no vaccine. So I think, you know, we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to the scientists who I write about in the book, Barney Graham and Jason McClellan, who invented the vaccine that is in both Pfizer and Moderna. It's a great, great accomplishment. So, and Trump deserves credit for approving that plan. Now, at the, you know, the saboteur, I would say, first of all, within that call with the governors, where he threw it in their laps, when they actually did order masks from China and so on, the federal government would seize it. Like the governor of Massachusetts, he ordered, I think, 3 million masks from China. It came into the port of New York, and it was seized by federal authorities. And after that, and that happened to a lot of different governors, but they started hiding their supplies from the federal government. It's just absurd. And then the mask thing, public health officials were slow to realize how important masks were. In traditional sense, masks were never really encouraged. We're on flus and stuff like that. So they were a break on that. And Matt Pottinger really deserves credit for actually pushing this in the White House and making it a policy. But when they got the president out there to announce the new policy, he said, well, you know, my counselors say the mask wearing works, and this may be the only thing we have left to do to stop the spread of the contagion. And I think, you know, they say you should wear it, and I'm not going to wear it, but if you want to wear it, you can wear it, but I'm not going to wear it. And immediately, it was a torpedo through the policy. He even went to a mask-making factory without a mask on. So, I mean...
But why? I mean, Larry, I think I keep coming back. The story that just broke my heart was... Matt Pottinger says Haynes is willing to put a mask in every mailbox. And this is after he shows the data that it's working. It's working. Let's do this. And they shoot him down. And I just don't understand why. Like, was it about masks that was worth not doing it? And that to a person, they were just like, we don't do that.
By that time, Tam, it had been elevated into a political divide. And, you know, the mask wearing... people were, Trump came to feel that they were protesting against him. And his defiance on the mask was, my people don't have to wear masks. And he claims he's never had the flu. He was bragging about his immune system. And of course, he got very, very ill. But I think, you know, the Trump administration was very conflicted. There were public health experts in there like Dr. Fauci and Deborah Birx who were stating very clearly what needed to be done. But there were other voices that arose, for instance, like on Fox News, easy outs, hydroxychloroquine, for instance. You know, it's a miracle cure. And it turned out it wasn't a cure at all. Scott Atlas was one who was advocating herd immunity. In other words, just let people get sick and then eventually we'll have herd immunity. And of course, you know, you have about 2% of those people who are going to die. But the great appeal of it, I think, for the Trump administration was you don't have to do anything. And that was a policy that the president really adhered to.
One of the things I liked the best about the book is I think that we in society now tend to paint people with a broad brush. If you worked for the Trump administration, you must be this. If you work for the Biden administration, you must do that. In particular with Matt Pottinger and Deborah Birx, you added a lot of depth to their story, this idea that, A, that we should have a lot more compassion and ask a lot more questions because there were people in there who were working really hard for the greater good. And Deborah Birx's case in particular, I mean, she just got torn apart by the end. But it seemed as though there was a lot more to the story, and it seemed to be an argument for take a step back before you paint everybody with a brush.
Yeah, thank you. I the truth is, when I started writing about Deborah Birx, she had been demonized. And it's, you know, as a reporter, you're hearing like a former director of the CDC telling me she's been a disaster. And I thought, well, you know, maybe so, you know. But when I started looking at what she was doing, she was the only one of the public health people who was actually in the White House. She had been the U.S. AIDS ambassador and had served very distinguishedly in Africa and had great accomplishments. And Pottinger asked her to come back to the U.S. and run the coronavirus task force. And when she left Africa, she told me she pretty much realized this would be the end of her career. Diseases like this carry stigmas that they're politicized, and she was going to be in the middle of it. And I think the fact that she was a woman also made a difference. You know, she was strong-minded, but she was enforceful. But her advocacy generated a tremendous amount of hostility in the White House. And, you know, one of the members of the Corona Task Force told me, you know, they hated her. They just hated her. And so did, you know, so did people that were in public health. Everybody hated her. And I thought, what's wrong with this? And what I observed is that she got essentially squeezed out of any influence. The president stopped seeing her. Of course, everybody remembers that horrible moment when he was talking about drink some bleach and let sunlight inside your body. And she, you could see her shoulders going back. You know, she was like taking a deep breath, but people blamed her for what he said, as if she should have stood up and said, that's nonsense, Mr. President. Well, she wasn't going to do that. But what happened after she lost influence in the White House is that she and her chief epidemiologist, Irum Zaidi, they took to the road and they went from state to state, 40 something states, and several of them a number of times, talking to governors, talking to university presidents, union leaders, tribal chiefs, telling them what they needed to do, sometimes scolding them in public, reading them the Riot Act. They were, you know, eating peanut butter sandwiches and getting, you know, coffee out of a Starbucks window. And they put on more than 25,000 miles. Irum Zaidi is something of a, she fancies herself as a really skilled driver. And she actually practices at the racetrack. And when she left Dallas, she was stopped by a DPS trooper in Dallas and for going 110. And so he, what's the rush, little lady? And she told him, and he did not give her a ticket, which as a Texan, I can testify, is a rare occurrence.
I think he realized she had somewhere truly that she needed to be.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk, a minute about Matt Pottinger, because I believe at the time when he resigned, there was a lot of, oh, now you resign. And you would hear that a lot. If you really meant it, you would have done it earlier. And the stories from him added to this idea that if I had left, who would have been there? Multiple times I wanted to leave, but I was worried about what would happen when I left the room.
Yeah.
And it seemed to add a little bit more credence that we should be thoughtful about that.
Well, he told me that at least on 7 occasions, he had written resignation letters and then, you know, he was in a mixed marriage. His wife was a Democrat. But she was also an immunologist at the CDC, and his brother was an epidemiologist in Washington State. So he was ideally placed as a source for me. But he wanted to quit. It really came to a head when the president tried to bully the Secretary of State in Georgia to overturn the vote. And Matt was the deputy national security advisor, and he and the security advisor talked it over, and they thought if they left, there would be nobody to run, you know, national security in the White House. And so out of a sense of obligation, they stayed. It wasn't until the insurrection that Matt decided it was too much and he couldn't stay any longer.
What do you think? Where do you think we would be if Trump had won in terms of where we are? You can pick which topic there in terms of the politics, the pandemic. I mean, I'm sure you've thought about this. What if it had gone in a different direction?
Honestly, I think that Trump was running against COVID, not against Joe Biden. And if you listen to his campaign speeches as it wound up, he's COVID, you know, and I've had it, look at me. You know, he was constantly referencing COVID because he knew that was his most vulnerable subject. And also, I trace in the book, as the campaign came to a climax, so did the pandemic. You know, this wave was cresting as the election neared. So every day he would be in a different set of cities, and every single day the pandemic was worse. So he was drowning in it. Had it not been for the pandemic, I think he would have won again. And how can we measure? Well, the Trump administration announced that by the end of 2020, there would be 40 million Americans who had been inoculated against the virus. And at the end of 2020, there were actually 2 million. I think by their own metric, that's a fair rendition of their competence in handling this pandemic.
Let's talk a little bit about Wuhan, which is where you open the book. And as you know, it became very politicized. This idea of, was it an accident? Something jumped from an animal to humans? Was it something that escaped a lab? Was it something purposely released from a lab? And the media sort of poo-pooed it, and it became that's just crazy talk. We're not, you know, that's not what happened. We're not looking at it. It's a little bit inconclusive. You can make arguments in any number of ways, and it feels like it's still an open question, and the government is saying we need to go back and look at it. Do you think we, the media, fell down on the job by not giving the idea that maybe there was something more here credence and pushing harder on that, instead thinking it was just kind of like a right-wing thing to say?
I do think that the press dropped the ball on it. When I was looking at this, you know, it's understandable that the first guess about where this came from would be from nature. It came from bats. Maybe it went through an intermediate animal. And, you know, there were people that were associated with this wet market in Wuhan who had gotten ill. That's what happened with SARS. So why wouldn't we think the same thing had happened with SARS-CoV-2, which is COVID-19's virus? Well, that began to fall apart. There were no, so far we've not discovered in bats or any other animal the COVID-19 virus. With SARS, there were lots of evidence of how this virus evolved and adapted to humans. You know, there were instances where people were infected, but weakly infected. And then, you know, the virus changed, as we see COVID-19 changing now, and slowly began to adapt itself to become a human disease. COVID-19 was almost perfectly adapted from the get-go. And moreover, it's not contagious to bats, or it doesn't seem to be. Hmm. So, but there are bat viruses that are very similar. And, you know, it emerged in November in Wuhan, which is 1,000 miles from the bat cave, and at a time when the bats would normally be hibernating. The Wuhan Institute of Virology is right there, as there is also another lab that does experiments on bat viruses. is if it were a if it had been manipulated in a lab, then you might imagine that they had been able to, they said that they were doing infectivity experiments. And what that means in a science sense is gain of function experiments. In other words, you take a virus that is an animal virus and you toy with it and see what it would take to turn it into a human virus, because one day it might be. And so there is a scientific reason to do those kinds of experiments, but they're incredibly dangerous. And there's a bird flu called H5N1, mm-hmm. which people occasionally catch from birds, poultry farmers and so on. 90% of them die. Now, suppose that became a human virus and swept through the population like COVID-19. It's almost unimaginable. But a scientist did an experiment, a gain of function experiment, to see what would it take to make it into human disease. And he did. Only three passes turned it into a highly infectious human disease. He might have well have invented a hydrogen bomb because it was that dangerous. And there was a lot of reaction to maybe we shouldn't be doing this in, for instance, population centers like Wuhan, where there are 11 million people. So there is no proof on either side. There's just an argument on each side. I don't think if it is a lab leak, and I think people should be familiar with the fact that lab leaks happen. Ebola and Nipah and others have leaked out of labs, even out of CDC. In the UK, smallpox leaked out three times.
Actually, in the book, you point out it's a lot more common than people realize.
It's scary. And I wish they weren't doing it in big population centers. But one of the papers I read said it only takes one careless graduate student to create an international pandemic.
Awesome.
Yep.
That'll keep you up at night. Yeah. I wanted to switch gears a little bit. You had mentioned, because we're talking about China, in the question, somebody had said, will you talk a little bit about the courageous Chinese who essentially faced down the government to try to tell the world about this?
Li Wenliang, he was an ophthalmologist in a hospital in Wuhan. And another courageous scientist, Dr. A, she had a patient. A number of doctors had patients with this suspicious pneumonia, but she had a lab test and she sent it into the lab and it came back SARS coronavirus. Well, it wasn't SARS. It was SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus, but that had not been recognized at that point. She sent out a note warning her colleagues to be careful. Not just careful of the disease, but, you know, it's highly, you know, with SARS-1, the Chinese were so sensitive about the possibility of a blowback that when international health authorities came to see what was going on, they took patients out of the hospital and hid them in ambulances and taxis until the authorities were gone. And the international health laws were changed because of that. And, you know, supposed to be more transparency and so on. And this was the first test. So when the doctors began to talk among themselves, it was closely held. There was a fear of it getting out, but they also wanted each other to know that SARS may be loose. And Dr. Li sent a note to his some of his college friends, medical school. And that is something that alerted the authorities. And he and seven other doctors were disciplined publicly on television. And, you know, it's humiliating. Dr. Ai, she gave an interview to Renwu magazine, which means people in Mandarin. And her interview was banned and, you know, taken off the web and so on. And the Chinese people have gotten to be very sophisticated about how to go around the government. And they started translating it into emojis and even Sindarin, this elfin language in the Hobbit books. They had figured out different ways to try to get the news out. So underground, people were learning. And the Chinese government was still saying it was not a human transmissible disease when Dr. Li caught it from a patient and then subsequently died of it. So people were enchanted by his personality. He was a noble and mild-mannered man. But now there are these letters to Dr. Li that you find on the internet that they're like prayers in a way. They're notes to some sort of comforter. You know, it's very touching, but it also suggests how oppressed so many people in China feel and how they wish that Dr. Li had been able to speak freely.
Do you think we'll ever have a final answer, a concrete answer on patient zero, what happened, or we just never will?
If we find that it came out of nature, we might. If it was a lab leak, I really doubt that the Chinese are going to ever allow evidence for that to surface. Their behavior is the primary thing that causes this suspicion. If they had been more transparent, for instance, you know, the intelligence community in the US has revealed recently that three researchers out of that lab in Wuhan went to the hospital with COVID-like symptoms in early November 2019. Why didn't the Chinese admit that? They have, part of the health regulations is they're supposed to provide samples of the virus so other nations can begin to make a test. You need the virus to make a test for it. And they refused to provide the US at least with a sample. So we didn't have we couldn't start making the test until January 20th, 3 weeks after the virus is first announced. When that first case came to Washington State, saying we had virus of our own. It's inexplicable. It's hostile. It's an absence of transparency, and it's irresponsible. So I'm angry about it. I don't know if it's a lab leak, but behavior like that invites a lot of distrust.
Is there anything that can be done? In fact, in the book, you note that part of why Matthew Pottinger is skeptical is because he'd been a reporter in China and he knew how these things went and he did not think they were telling the truth. So, I mean, but you're sort of left with, there's really nothing you can do except almost accept that's just the way it is when you deal with China.
I think, one thing that I hope will come out of this is we need to have a real World Health Organization that has teeth. It's the WHO is a supplicant. It doesn't have any authority. It depends on its member states to, you know, award it the opportunity to go in and examine what's going on, but they can't do it on their own. These diseases are too dangerous to allow these kind of parochial political decisions to block the stopping of, block the transmission of a disease like COVID-19 or SARS or any of those diseases. Since the turn of the century, we've had Ebola and SARS and H1N1 and West Nile and Zika. I mean, there's a cascade of new diseases, and this is just the latest, and it certainly won't be the last. We just have to be prepared to demand openness from countries that are infected.
You spend a lot of time with people in the science community in various agencies. And I think you paint a compelling picture of what they were up against. The people who knew their stuff, who dedicated a lifetime of doing this and were tearing their hair out against some political bureaucrats, if you will. You mentioned Scott Atlas, and we'll just walk around and get herd immunity at some point. Or Michael Caputo, who was a spokesman for the HHS, what an off the rails video, you know, make sure you're buying bullets and, you know, nothing to calm people down. Alex Azar doesn't seem to tell the truth at any point in the book. And I think it was eye opening to many people how politicized our health agencies could get. As you talk to your sources, what is the path forward? What would need to happen so that we restore faith in the CDC, the NIH, HHS, that we believe that these are organizations that are capable of resisting, no matter who the president is, no matter what the politics are? Because I think a lot of people feel as though their trust in them has been undermined.
Well, and justly so. Our health institutions failed us, and the CDC most notably. It's going to take time, Tam. It's not going to happen overnight. The ranks in since 2008, I think, the 66,000 jobs in public health have disappeared. We've thinned out the ranks, and the talent pool has drained. When I was a young reporter and I was doing stories that took me to CDC, I was so impressed. The people I met there, they were brilliant. They were courageous. They were humble. You know, I just thought they were noble in some way, you know, and they regarded that institution as sacred. Nobody thinks that now. And there are CDCs all over the planet that have been built in emulation of the institution that we built. And we have to restore the faith in our public health institutions, not just for our sake, but for the rest of the world.
You talk at the end of the book, you know, it's the insurrection that pushes Matt Pottinger out the door. He just says, there's a reason why I don't have any pictures up in this office. I need to be able to go at a moment's notice. And this is that moment. And yet we are here with Congress not being able to pass a commission to get to the bottom of what happened. And I think my favorite line here may come from Peggy Noonan, who says, you know, it's always a bit of a mess in a whorehouse. Yes, it's a mess in a whorehouse, but every now and then something incredible happens, miracles happen, and they meet the moment. But that does not seem as though it's going to be the case in figuring out what happened and where are we going. And so I just kind of wondered where that left you after hearing his personal accounts, the idea that we're not going to get an official record, that we're not going to uncover what happened and try to put some safeguards up against it.
Well, it's demoralizing. But on the other hand, Tam, I think that the Republicans have made a poor bargain. Rather than just getting it all out and moving on, it's going to be a dribble for a decade. And, you know, books will come out, memoirs, things will turn up. You know, the Trump administration will be facing legal charges that'll drag on for a long time. You know, it's, you know, if you deal with it up front, then you can move on. But I think that what the Republicans have done to themselves is they've parked themselves in a place where they're not going to be able to move on for a long time.
Is that something that you might be interested in looking at for the next book?
Oh, thank you. I am dying to find a new book. And every time I finish a project, it's like I've lost my job. And so I'm unemployed right now. And I'm very eager to write about something. But, you know, I've been in this business a long time, you know, and I don't know how many more books I have in me. And so I have to be choosy, but too choosy, you don't ever do anything. So I'm at a crossroads, and I'm not sure what's going to appear, but I'm looking.
Well, after the looming tower in this one, if you could get to the bottom of what exactly went on, I think a lot of folks would find that riveting reading. Yeah. At one point, it's a very stirring section of the book. You talk about going, you and your wife, and dropping off your vote in a drop box, and all of the people who showed up, that despite all the divisions and everything that was going on, they showed up to save their country. And as you know, in our home state, I'm a Houston girl, there's a huge push to change the voting laws. And it's not just in Texas, it's in a lot of states. And I just wonder your thoughts on these bills and what it could mean in the future, that the people standing up to vote any which way they could, they were exercising their voice and their power in the only way they could in a pandemic. What happens if a lot of that goes away?
Well, you know, this was a really unusual election, and there have been presidential elections in the past where people were, you know, highly, highly motivated to vote. But this one was extraordinary. And, you know, it was also a moment, a crossroads for our country, I think. I think everybody who voted felt the same way, whether you were a Trump supporter or a Biden supporter, everybody felt that the future was on the line. And I think it was. I think that our country, I think a lot of people thought, well, we changed. We changed administrations, and now people are beginning to feel like this may be an interim period. The forces that gave rise to Trump and Trump himself will return. And that might be true. But my assessment of this is that the government right now is doing what government is supposed to do. And there are some things that only government can do. And really, since the Reagan administration, there's been this constant disparagement of government, especially by the Republican Party. And only private industry can do things. Well, there are some things that private industry can't do. And getting Americans to get vaccinated is one of those things. So you see government in action. I think it's going to change some people's minds. The way I look at it is, you know, right now we have two political parties. There's the Democrats and the anti-Democrats. And we need a conservative Republican Party. The country works best when we have
two parties
falling from both sides. And we don't have that right now. There's a struggle to create some kind of bipartisanship. I commend the president and people in both parties who are working toward that. But if we can break through this tribal division, then I think that will be a great, great accomplishment.
Somebody asked in one of the questions, what was the high point and the low point for you personally getting through the pandemic year? And throughout the book, you write about yourself and what it was like living through all of this, kind of being trapped in your house or being worried about your health, pre-existing conditions, and what it was like finally to go get your own vaccine. So what was the high and the low?
Well, the highlight really for me was getting my shot. It's a liberating feeling. If you haven't had a shot yet, you don't realize the sense of freedom that that now you are immune and you can drop the mask and, you know, you can go out to eat and those kinds of things. That was, and I wrote a thank you note to while I was waiting for the reaction. You know, you get to wait for 15 minutes after your shot. I wrote a thank you note to Barney Graham and Jason McClellan, who invented the vaccine that was now circulating in my body. A low point, it's not exactly, I wouldn't frame it as a low point in the sense that the question maybe is meant. But I think what I ran into in researching this was a whole lot of grief. And that hadn't been something that had been very much in public discourse, and certainly nothing that had been said in the president's, you know, in the Oval Office before the end of the Trump administration. 500,000 Americans, now close to 600,000, have died, and their deaths have been scarcely remarked. And I think people were in mourning for loved ones that they lost, and I ran into a lot of that, and there were a lot of tears on my part as well. But also there was grief about what had happened to our country, how we had stumbled and fallen. And, you know, that was another thing that I felt it hadn't been acknowledged. And so in the sense of having to deal with things that were depressing and hard to support, you know, those moments were hard for me because I was carrying these stories that people were telling me were so moving. And you can't just walk away from those things. You know, Tam, how people's stories like that, you become a vessel for their stories. And that's a privilege. But on the other hand, part of it remains with you. And it never affects the reader as much as it did you.
In the book, you write about what it is to be older and in the population that seems to be dying from this, the minorities and older people were at particular risk. And at one point in the book, you say, I can't help but wonder, you know, what would happen if the people who were most affected were whiter, younger, richer, better known? You know, would we have all, like you say, these people are scarcely remarked. Would we have had a different reaction to their death?
Well, you know, the 1918 flu was totally different in that regard. It was young and vigorous people who were the most likely to die. It was because their immune system killed them. They overreacted. And I think that part of the terror of the 1918 flu was that it was, the youth who were most at risk. As an old man, I can say that there was a sort of, I felt that the possibility of my death was somewhat discounted because I wouldn't have lost as much life. But on the other hand, I didn't want to lose any of my life. You know, it becomes increasingly precious the closer you get to the end of it, I can tell you. So there was that. And you begin to realize that, your own vulnerability. And I think that every person, as he or she ages, comes to terms with that. You know, youth is gone. You suddenly beset with the diseases that you've heard about, and it happens to you. And it's what's interesting to me is it's a surprise. it happened to me. You know, that's the thing that I think is so absurd about our aging process is that, at least for me and a lot of my friends, you know, growing old has been a constant surprise.
Somebody in the questions asked about India and what should the WHO be doing there? And do you have any thoughts on, I mean, they've had a terrible time. Like while we are at least moving in the right direction, much of Europe is, some Asian countries are doing well, they are doing horribly. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, do you know, Tam, that more people have died this year already of COVID-19 than died in all of 2020. Oh. And, you know, Brazil and a lot of South America and India, you know, they're just, the death toll is staggering. India is a little puzzling because India is a pharmaceutical powerhouse. It produces much of the world's medicines and was producing a lot of vaccine. They apparently didn't save enough for their own population. There probably is hesitancy in India as well as other countries as ours is, but I can't speak very well about, you know, Indian politics because I don't know anything about it. But when I look at India now, I can't help but think about what America would have been like without the vaccines. The countries that did very well in 2020, Vietnam, South Korea, so on, Japan, are having a real struggle right now because they haven't been able to vaccinate their populations adequately. And so, you know, that their initial actions haven't saved them in this round of the infection.
And I think this is a good place to end something from the CEO of Moderna, who said, I think we're going to be living with the virus forever. And I wanted a little bit more insight into what they meant. And, you know, how soon do you think before we find ourselves in the next pandemic?
You know, the coronavirus, you know, there are a lot of different diseases that are caused by coronavirus, and four of them are classified as the common cold. The common cold is caused by not just coronaviruses, but others. But it's possible that at one point in human history, these cold viruses were as serious as SARS or MERS or COVID-19. And over time, they became less serious. This is the usual course of diseases, but not inevitable. They diminish as they adapt to the human host. The goal of the disease is just to propagate. It's not to kill, but oftentimes they do. Now, this disease is rapidly evolving. And it was odd because when it first came out of China, it was already at a high state of evolution for being adapted to humans. And then there was an adaptation in Italy that became more contagious. And then, you know, CDC started setting up centers for genomic sequencing and stuff like that. And then for 10 months, they didn't have anything. And then fireworks, you know, one after another, you know, the UK variant, the South African, the Brazil, and now the Delta, is it called, the Indian variant. This right now, this virus is popping, it's churning. And it is, when we talk about variants, in a way, they're all different diseases. You know, they each have a different strategy. And one day, you know, we may have a variant that escapes the immunity that our vaccines have provided. So far, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have been almost perfect. You know, it's just unbelievable that they've been able to stand up against all this, all these new strains. So we're lucky. The only thing we have to protect us is getting everybody vaccinated, because the more people are vaccinated, the fewer people who will get infected, and the less chance that there is that the virus will find another human host in which it can shuffle a genetic deck and come out with something new. And that's why it's dismaying to see that our vaccination efforts have begun to stall. That's a long way of saying, you know, we haven't been able to eradicate this disease. The disease is more adept in many respects than we are. Its purpose is clear, and it will continue to evolve, and we'll just have to learn how to live with it.
Well, thank you for the book. Thank you for this hour, and thank you to everybody who's joined in. I learned quite a bit, and I think it just humanized it in a way that the daily coverage, as great as a lot of it was, it went to a different depth. So thank you again.
Thank you. My pleasure, Tam.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.